It's just kind of stupid.
Good morning. I'd like to bring the House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection to order on Tuesday, May 17th. Our agenda today, I think we're going to go right down the agenda as presented. And so with that, I will open a work session and possible reconsideration on Senate Bill 448. Representative Wisnett, entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 440.
Co-Chair Wisnett moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 440. Is there any objection? Having the necessary votes, the motion carries and the rules have been suspended.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 440 was sent to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Wisnett moves that we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 440 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
You want to tell us what the amendment, didn't you put an amendment in?
Well, yeah, we'll get there.
Okay.
Is there any objection? The motion carries and the vote has been reconsidered.
Chair Hovey, I move LC-5 amendment stated May the 5th, 2011 to Senate Bill 440 be adopted.
Co-Chair Wisnett moves the LC-A5 amendments dated May 5th, 2011 to Senate Bill 440 be adopted. We'll have a little discussion. Jan, would you give us a little description of what we're doing with the A5 amendment, please?
Well, Mr. Chair and committee members, when President Courtney testified, he talked about legislative members would not be eligible for per diem if they participated in a board or commission meeting by telephone. And the bill did not make that very clear, and so you have before you an A5 amendment that spells out very clearly that legislative members will not be eligible for per diem when they participate by telephone.
Thank you. And that, committee members, was the purpose after we looked at the bill. It did appear that there was some ambiguity as to whether or not the bill accomplished Senator Courtney's goal. So we did discuss this with his office about bringing it back and including this amendment. Any other discussion? Seeing none. Representative Wisnett,
we got to vote on the amendment. Is that next?
So the motion carries.
So if there is no objection to adopting the amendment, seeing none, the amendment is adopted. Representative Wisnett.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 440 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Co-Chair Wisnett moves Senate Bill 440 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Tamara, could we have a vote, please?
Representative Cameron.
Excused.
Representative Clem.
Yes. Aye.
Representative Conger.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan.
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Co-Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Holby.
Aye. Senate Bill 440, having received required votes, is passed to the floor. Carrier on this bill.
I'll carry for you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Matthews will be our carrier. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 440 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 14. Jan, would you give us a description on Senate Bill 414, please?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 14 allows the state treasurer to authorize exceptions to the requirements for depositing public funds in order to allow state agencies to conduct business through the use of electronic commerce, unless a depository can provide the service in a cost-effective manner. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage. There are no amendments before you, there's no revenue impact, and there's no fiscal impact.
Thank you. And we have up Cora Parker and Mike Silvaggio. Good morning. If you'd identify yourself for the record, and welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chair Holby, members of the committee. For the record, Mike Silvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer. We bring to you this morning Senate Bill 14, which comes from the Senate on a 30-0 vote. This is I could categorize it as a housekeeping measure, except it is a little bit more than that. It creates a small but tightly controlled exception in the public depository rules to allow the Treasury to facilitate certain online transactions. It's somewhat complicated for me, so I will turn it over to our Finance Director, Cora Parker, who should be able to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you, Mike. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, Cora Parker, the Finance Director with the State Treasurer's Office. As Mike indicated, this, while slightly more than a housekeeping bill, is a very limited exception to the public depository requirements in RRS Chapter 295. Agencies who utilize depository functions are typically required, well, not typically, are required to use qualified in-state depositories right now. And we have found that there are some limited places, particularly in the e-commerce realm, where that's problematic. I'll give you two specific exceptions, and I'll tell you that right now those are the only exceptions where we have found this problem and what this bill is trying to solve. Those are the state surplus program through the Department of Administrative Services and the estate sales program through the Division of State, the Department of State Lands. You'll note that those programs right now are using eBay as their primary selling service. And so you would ask, why do you need an exception if eBay is working right now, if that model is working? Well, the answer is that eBay has actually granted the state of Oregon an exception to their typical process, which is use of their PayPal function. We have a very limited exception when the eBay has indicated to us they will not allow us to continue for very much longer. And if we do not have this bill in place allowing, again, an exception on our side of the table, then we would no longer be able to be in that partnership with eBay to provide those services. That type of service really is the very limited exception where we see this this bill really having an impact with the state of Oregon at all. We would use a third-party vendor process to make sure that PayPal or any other depository solution that was brought to us by our vendor met all of our other state of Oregon requirements, all of the other depository requirements, provisions with respect to 24-hour depository requirements under 293.265 would still be in place. So while PayPal could be utilized as that initial depository, there still would be the 24-hour window for those funds to be pulled back into a qualified state of Oregon depository. So, again, this is a very limited exception. We do not see that very many agencies would utilize it at all. The additional amendments that were brought forward in the Senate clarified that such an amendment could only be used if the Treasurer's Office also found that there was not a qualified State of Oregon depository who could perform a similar service at a cost-effective rate. So that's an additional threshold that will be placed on that on this exception, and we're fine with that. We think that's very reasonable and very worth your consideration. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have. Otherwise, we urge your support and approval of this very limited exception that will allow a couple of very important state programs, however, to continue in the model that they have right now.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? I'm just curious, so is there a contract with eBay essentially then, or would eBay be able to basically change their mind down the road and say, we really don't want to offer this service anymore?
Mr. Co-Chair, right now I believe the Department of Administrative Services has a contract with them for their they're selling services in general, and within that contract is also built in this exception to their typical PayPal-based mechanism. That exception allowed us to also drive a very specific technology solution that allowed our funds to be deposited directly into a state, a qualified state depository. As you can imagine, eBay has continued to grow in the marketplace, and frankly, we need them more than they need us, and so they've let us know that that exception really won't continue for very much longer at all. And so that's why this mechanism, which is an exception now on our side instead of their side, is required. As far as a long-term contract, just for the base use of the sale product itself, that would obviously be something between the Department of Administrative Services and eBay or whatever vendor they ultimately wanted to utilize for those services.
Thank you. Other questions? Seeing any, thank you very much for this exceptional bill, and appreciate your testimony this morning. Not seeing anyone else signed up for Senate Bill 14. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 14. Jan, I believe our paperwork's in order on this one, so I'm going to open the work session on Senate Bill 14. Representative Wisnant.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 14 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves Senate Bill 14 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Seeing none, Tamara, can we have a vote, please?
Representative Cameron.
Excused.
Representative Clem.
Yes.
Representative Conger.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan.
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Co-Chair Wisnant.
Yay.
Co-Chair Holby.
Aye. Jan, what was the vote out of the Senate on this particular bill? Just for purposes of a consent calendar consideration?
Mm-hmm. It's 30 to nothing.
30-0.
Is there any objection to placing this on the consent calendar? Seeing none, let's try this one on the consent calendar.
Third one.
With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 14 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 292.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 292 was before the committee May 5th. It's a bill that prohibits imposing financial obligation on a consumer who accepts a free offer unless the offer complies with disclosure and billing information requirements. There's a Dash A5 amendment before you that eliminates the emergency clause.
Thank you. We have signed up to testify, Mike Dewey.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Co-Chair Mike Dewey, members for the record, representing DeHart and Dar. I've been working with legislative counsel on an amendment that I discussed with you at the first hearing, and I didn't get it right the first time, and I would ask if we could have some more time. I think I can get this right. Let me explain what we're trying to do here. This is for free offers, and in the offer there is a right to cancel and how to cancel. And as I described to you, there are offers that are sometimes made by an entity that is not providing the service, the goods, and therefore we were looking for, and I'm talking specifically about publications, so we were looking for language to provide a path for publications so that they could provide the information to the individual who accepted the free offer, for example, at a bookstore like Borders, and we could provide that information by mail to them, either if there's an invoice that goes out that explains how they cancel the free offer, number one, and number two, the procedure they can cancel and the procedure to do that. So we're really not changing the principles of this proposed legislation. We think it makes sense because, again, for a number of these people, the requirement would be a toll-free number, which can be fairly expensive. And the other is you've got to cancel in a manner similar to the way that you accepted the offer. And that's really impossible with this kind of a publication where the offer is made at a store like Borders or Barnes & Noble. So with that, I'm trying to figure out a path, and I'm working with counsel to do that. I've provided additional amendments, and I think we can get there. So I'd like to ask for more time, and clearly the emergency clause needs to go away with this bill, and you have that amendment. So I am asking for more time on this and working on an amendment.
Questions for Mr. Dewey? Mr. Dewey, I'm curious if you're working with the proponents of this bill on the other side of this building on this particular amendment.
I've had a conversation with Senator Bonamici's staff and the Attorney General's office about these amendments or amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I don't think we are doing anything that would cause an exemption or obviate in any way what this bill is intended to do. The bill is to provide notice. I came late to this on publications, in that we saw that there was a problem in terms of how publications are now offered up to the public, often at bookstores. And again, we would still provide the information that you have the right to cancel, and two, how to cancel the free offer.
And so this amendment would be specific to publications?
To publications.
All right, thank you. Representative Matthews.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And thanks, Mr. Dewey, for your testimony and your time on this issue. You came to my office. I appreciate you giving me a heads up and what you're doing and describing your intent. My only comment would be in regards to the removal of the emergency clause. I completely agree. I think that, you know, I don't see the need to fast-track this through and make these changes right away without letting an industry have, you know, the ability to give the heads up and educate their folks on how they need to comply with the new law. So if we're going to make that change, I certainly hope that that we all agree that that emergency clause is not necessary. We passed a number of bills without it, and some of them far more important than this. So I hope we can do that.
Any other discussion? Thank you very much, Mr. Dewey.
Thank you for your time.
Is there anyone else that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 292?
Mr. Chair? No, but I have a question, Mr. Dewey. When will we be able to carry it over? Will the amendment be back? In the next, by Thursday? Or
I talked to council late yesterday, and we plan to talk this morning.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. And Senator Bonamici, we're in a public hearing on Senate Bill 292. I don't know if you came to speak to that particular bill or not.
I did, Mr. Co-Chair.
Please come up. Your timing is impeccable.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Culture wasn't. Sorry, I'm a little bit out of breath. I was on my way to judiciary, and I passed the TV screen, and there you were. And I wanted to just come in and sorry, I'm Senator Suzanne Bonamici, representing Senate District 17. I just wanted to make a couple of clarifications on Senate Bill 292A. It's my understanding that I heard Mr. Dewey at least most of his testimony. I wanted to point out that in the bill on page 2, the section about cancellation on lines 25 to 28, does not require necessarily a toll-free number. It says to cancel by calling a toll-free number or to cancel in a manner substantially similar to that by which the consumer accepted the free offer. So I believe that there's certainly some room for his client to come up with a cancellation method that's similar to the method by which they offered the free trial. I am fine with the removing the emergency clause. That amendment I'm fine with. I do want to point out that we had several work group meetings on this bill. It actually started back in the 2009 session, continued throughout the interim. We had lots of people, including Mr. Dewey, around the table. We had somebody from the Direct Marketing Association in Washington, D.C., who actually flew in for some of our meetings. We were flattered and honored to have him with us. Sometimes he participated by telephone, but my point is that Mr. Co-Chairs and committee, that we had a lot of people around the table when we crafted this legislation. The final meeting that we had, there was one change to change, I believe it was an and to an or, and that's how much time we spent on it. We really worked very hard to make sure that we had a bill that that we believed was fair and workable. So I do support removing the emergency clause. I don't think further amendment is needed to give the flexibility that that Mr. Dewey mentioned. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Senator, for coming over and seeing us and visiting us. Would you expand your comment? We can move this Thursday with the amendment. Would you oppose if we get the additional amendment?
I don't, Mr. Co-Chair Wisnett and committee, I support an amendment to remove the emergency clause, if that's the amendment that you're referencing.
No.
I saw another amendment that I didn't think was necessary. I don't know that if you have that before you, but an amendment to remove the emergency clause, I'm fine with that.
Other questions from the committee? Senator, thank you very much for stopping in your travels.
And thank you for considering this bill.
So, anyone else wanting to testify on Senate Bill 292? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 292. And I'll stand at ease for just a second, please. House Committee, and we are reconvening also the public hearing on Senate Bill 292, or I am closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 292 now and opening a work session on Senate Bill 292.
Mr. Chair, I move the -585 amendments dated May 11, 2011 to Senate Bill 292 be adopted.
Representative Wisnett moves the -5 amendments to Senate Bill 292, dated May 11, 2011, be adopted. Discussion? Seeing none, Tamara, can we have a vote, please?
Representative Cameron?
Excused.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Condon?
I'm sorry, we're just voting on the -5 amendments, correct?
Correct.
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Co-Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
Co-Chair Holby?
Aye.
The -5 amendment, Senate Bill 292, is adopted, and we will close the work session on Senate Bill 292 with the intent of carrying that bill over. Next on our agenda, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 487. Jan, could you give us a description of Senate Bill 487, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee members. Senate Bill 487, it prohibits offers of automatic renewal or continuous service arrangements unless the offer complies with disclosure requirements. And it prohibits charging a customer without first obtaining the consumer's affirmative consent to the offer. Requires providing an acknowledgement that can be retained by the consumer that contains the terms of the offer and the cancellation policy. Declares a violation to be an unlawful trade practice. Declares an emergency effective on passage. There's a dash A4 amendment before you that specifies that automatic renewal does not include plans or arrangements that automatic renew but allow customer to cancel by providing written notice within 30 days. There's no revenue impact and there's no fiscal impact.
Thank you. So up for testimony on this, I have John Huddle, Angela Martin, and John Bartholomew, please.
Good morning, co-chairs Holvey, WISNET, and committee members. I'm John Huddle from Deschutes County. I'm here to testify in support of this bill. You know, when I look at bills like this that are attempting to hold businesses to a common standard, I think of Teddy Roosevelt and his stance on big business. And he says we can't expect, paraphrasing him, we can't expect that can give them a square deal if we don't give them advance information about what they should and should not do. Well, technology has changed, but this bill, in the way I see it, is attempting to hold corporations to a common standard of decency and conduct that was first proposed by Teddy Roosevelt almost 100 years ago. I have personal experiences with this kind of an issue. About a year ago, my son asked my help in renewing his Xbox online gaming membership. That's a Microsoft corporation, one of our largest corporations in America. I discovered that he couldn't renew because he had automatically attempted to renew a year later with an old credit card. So when I used my credit card, not only did they renew once, they renewed twice. When I tried to get them to correct it, they renewed again. So I took them to the Attorney General's office. And that was after dealing with a representative in the Philippines. It got my attention. And you know, I'm a former non-com in the Army. Somebody gets my attention, it's probably not a good idea. The long and short of that was that after several times of dealing back and forth, Microsoft refunded all charges and gave my son a year's free membership. What I would like to do, and I have the testimony here, sorry, I forgot to hand this out, but
thank you.
What I pointed out to the, essentially to the customer service representative, this seemed fraudulent. You're automatically renewing. You don't allow, Microsoft does not allow people to renew online on their TV screen when they're using the Xbox device. Instead, they have to go to the computer or they have to call an 800 number that is kind of flashed across the screen. So it's not exactly convenient. In fact, it seems geared to continue a membership whether you want it or not. And the comment I made to the representative from the Attorney General's office is that an awful lot of juveniles play this game. I've had a school psychologist, I've had parents consult me about their kids playing it. So I know that they're putting this information in. I know how kids work. They put pressure on the parents, and the next thing you know, there's a credit card on there, and a year later they're renewing it. They may not even be using Xbox anymore if they've seen some of the content of some of the games. But anyway, that was my experience. It's also been my experience that Microsoft will hold your credit card number and keep it for other things, like if you purchase an online movie through their Zune division or department. You find that they've held it, and they say you have to go to the website to cancel. I can't find a place on their website to cancel it. So this bill really addresses a need that's out there. And if you look at doing a search online for things, keywords like unauthorized renewal or unauthorized charges, you'll find a lot of complaints about this issue. So it's a very important bill. Secondly, I would want to oppose the amendment that's before you, the Dash 4 today. This seems to kind of gut the major features of this bill. People that are authorizing by one method ought to be able to, by default, know that it's not going to be continued, and if they want to cancel, they ought to be able to cancel in the same method that they made their purchases. Happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee? Representative Conger.
Thank you for being here today, Mr. Huddle. I appreciate you driving over. And I just had a question. So you said you contacted the AG's office. Did you get help?
Yes. Yes, but that would not have had help without them.
So I guess, and I don't know the answer to this. This is a sincere question. What do we need the bill for? If you already are, if you were able to get help from the AG's office, how does the bill provide additional
The bill prevents
protection?
The corporation from automatically renewing without express approval. And that's the important thing. Because these are renewing a year later. People have forgotten that they've even how they've done it at that point. Just keep in mind that for things like Xbox, you can also purchase a card from a store. In fact, that's how I did it the second time. But for many people, they're not going to do that. You know, the convenience of using your credit card or your bank card, or I think even your checking account. We need a way for people to say, no, I don't want to automatically be charged a year later. I want to be notified. Then I'll pay if I want to continue the service.
Representative Sheehan.
So is it your testimony that Microsoft didn't let you know that they would charge your card again?
No, they did not.
They did not. Microsoft, with all their lawyers and all those disclosures that I see all the time when I renew my PlayStation membership.
They did not. They might have it there, but it's small print and it's flashed.
So you didn't see it.
We didn't see it. If it was there, it wasn't in a manner that could be seen and readily recognized that this is what was going to happen a year later. And it did not have a venue that allowed you to cancel in a convenient manner. It was through a number of roadblocks to not canceling, but to preventing an automatic renewal.
Did the Attorney General find that this was that they behaved incorrectly?
Well, the Attorney General takes this, in my experience, takes these kind of cases to the point if it's resolved, then it's resolved and they don't go any further. It's when it's not resolved that they have a finding. Although I haven't looked online to see how many complaints they've had on Microsoft.
Other questions for this witness? We'll go ahead and hear the rest of the testimony. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Angela Martin, testifying in support of Senate Bill 487A on behalf of Economic Fairness Oregon, a statewide nonprofit consumer advocacy group. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. In my testimony that I submitted, I included a contract from Match.com. I hazard a guess that by the time I'm finished with my testimony, you won't be able to have found the automatic renewal notice. Everyone's going to shuffle through. This is typical of the type of gotcha sales techniques that buries the customer notice into the fine print. When Economic Fairness signed up for their Match.com profile, they had to click, or I had to click, on a link which led us to this fine print several pages into that notice. By the time you actually, and congratulations, looks like we found someone that reached it. Senate Bill 487.
It's his contract. I'm sorry, for the record.
Yes, my personal account.
Senate Bill 487 would not make it illegal to offer an automatic renewal. It simply says that when the customer makes that authorization to, or the consent to say, yes, I want this service, that the notice is put in a clear and conspicuous manner next to that consent box, next to the form that they mail in, if it's a type of subscription, or it's a audibly understood message if it's something that you agree to over the phone. We feel that this is a basic building block of consumer protection. Again, not that it bans any sort of automatic renewal, but that it makes that automatic renewal consent very easy for the customer to understand when they pass over their credit card. Thank you for your opportunity to testify.
Good morning.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Bartholomew. I'm a policy advocate with the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, OSPIRG. We support this bill as a basic consumer protection, and I just want to say what some of the impact can be on the average consumer when they are unaware that an automatic renewal has happened. I mean, there's many companies that do provide you with a 30-day notice before they automatically renew. For example, I have a Yahoo email account with Pop Access. I get an email a month before it's ready to renew and ask me, do you want to keep doing this? If not, go to our website and cancel. That's great. However, I had another subscription with another service that did not send me that warning, and all of a sudden I see on my debit account that I had a $30 charge, and I recognize, oh, I had completely forgotten about that. I would not have renewed that had I wanted to, had I known about it. And if I was living close to the edge, and many people are with their checking account, where, like, you know, they're keeping track of things, if they don't know that there's going to be a $30 charge or a $50 charge coming up, they might be at the point where it's going to trigger overdraft fees. Now, in many cases, you can get a refund if something has automatically canceled and you want to get out of it. You know, I could have called this one company that charged me $30 and said, I don't want to pay that, and I want to get out of my contract for the new year. They would have done that, but had I received an overdraft already, that would have not been something I could have gotten out of. So, I mean, that's just one small example of the kinds of things that will be remedied by this particular bill. It's a basic consumer protection that I think would be good for the consumers of the state. So, thank you very much for your time. Happy to answer any questions.
Questions for this group? Representative Wisnett.
John, do you have a comment on Dash 4?
I only just saw it, so I do not have a comment on it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions for this panel?
Yeah. Does anybody have further comment on the Dash 4 amendments? I haven't seen them either.
Co-chair, members of the committee, I just read it as well, and it appears to do what was suggested, that it says it's not actually necessary, so we would not be in support of the Dash 4 amendment.
Thank you. Representative Conger.
This is more of a comment, but inviting a response. I'll bet there's no one here who doesn't hate getting those automatic renewal notices when you didn't intend to automatically renew. And in the same vein, I think, when in interactions in commerce, you feel like you got tricked, like, I don't know, your Microsoft experience or something like that. And then you have to take your time to try to go and correct something that you didn't intend and that you somehow, but your credit card got charged, so ultimately your choice is just accept it and write the money off, even though it wasn't your fault, or go through the time and the effort to call the automated voicemail system and you know, press 050 times trying to get a live person so you can actually get it fixed. And so in spirit, I certainly support the idea of having full disclosure, having a simple way to cancel if you didn't intend to automatically renew. But I worry a little bit that what's the likelihood that anyone is actually going to enforce the law? Because, you know, frankly, if I get a $7 charge on my credit card, I'm not likely to go to the Attorney General because it just takes too much time. It's too much effort. I wouldn't even go through the voicemail system. And I also think, to some extent, eventually, most people won't deal with vendors who take advantage of them. So, for example, with Microsoft, John, maybe you still are dealing with Microsoft because your child is sort of persuading you to do so, but in the long run, you're not going to deal with a vendor that repeatedly does this to you. And I think that, you know, to some extent, they're self-defeating behavior. So my point is, and I guess my question is, do you think that this is really going to do any good? And will we really be creating more statutory requirements that few people will know of and fewer will follow and will not likely get enforced or really do what we intended to do, but will cause more cost for those honest vendors who might not be really hurting the consumer anyway?
Well, to respond to that, co-chairs and Representative Conger, I think for many of us in a position, $7 charge isn't a big deal. But having dealt with a number of parents that are, you know, struggling to make it, that $7 is the final straw, and they're going to hit the ceiling. And yes, they will contact the Attorney General or some advocacy agency. I don't think it'll put a burden on those that are already doing it, doing what they should do, being ethical, because they are already doing this. It's the ones that aren't. And the problem is, just as Teddy Roosevelt saw back at the turn of the last century, it's the big businesses, it's the giants that can do this and get away with it, and it literally means millions in their pockets, and the consumer has no other place to turn. So if your Xbox has a not just a monopoly on a certain type of gaming that's very popular, they also are a big provider of video streaming of content, where consumers are moving away from the cable and the satellite to movies and everything coming through the internet. And let me give you an instance of this. I have canceled everything but internet now. I've got a Roku box, and you're supposed to be able to access all your internet through there. I expected that some of those will be for fee. Well, surprise, I got to put a credit card in it before it'll activate. And there is no provision or no notice that when they're going to automatically renew some of those charges. So we have a whole new industry that's opening up that potentially can really victimize consumers, because some of these are small players that could be very unethical or they could be very ethical. But we need a level playing ground so we don't unfairly penalize those like Yahoo that are doing a good job.
Representative Matthews.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. You know, I, I agree with your comments. I struggle with this, too, because there's oftentimes I think that we are trying to sometimes protect people from themselves. I'm not suggesting that's what we're doing here. But it is a hustle and hurried world, and a lot of folks don't take time to read the fine print. They enter into agreements, they enter into contracts without ever following through or reading to what it means because, wow, I just want that smartphone today. I got to have it. I'll sign up for whatever it takes to get out the door with the smartphone. And that's happening, too. And I think that we have to understand, too, that when people are entering into agreements, I mean, we were somewhat challenged with the Match.com, and it took all of 25 seconds, I think, for him to find it. He was looking for it. But I think we've got to be very cautious about what we're trying to do to protect people without putting a burden of proof on their end, too, saying they're responsible to do this as well and to follow through to make sure that they're reading the contract, that they know what they're getting into and what they're entering into. I'm not suggesting that's true in every case, but I did notice a wide variety of exemptions to this bill and wondered if maybe you could talk about why those folks will be exempted when you look at who's excluded from the bill.
I can't talk to that because I wasn't party to that during the testimony on the other side. I think you'd have to ask Senator Bonamici for that. I would push back, though, on responsibility, because if you looked at some of these contracts, and remember, if you're doing something online on a computer screen, you don't have a hard copy, you go to print it, you discover that it's cumbersome, you've moved away from your page that you're on, sometimes with no link back, or it's simply, you know, ream after ream of documentation. I think what this bill is getting at is you could have put it out there where it's going to stand out, because it is important and it is something that's going to happen perhaps a year later, and people need to know that. And you know, we're in a time when people are struggling, and you know, maybe $30 doesn't mean much to you or I, but it does mean something to a single mom that's purchasing an online subscription for a child. And then a year later, when she's ready to pay the rent or the electric bill, which where I live would be worse, and all of a sudden that electric bill check bounces and the electricity's off. So there's nasty consequences that this could fix without, I think, a whole lot of cost to corporations.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Yeah, maybe John. Do we have any data on what percentage of consumers these days are reading online contracts? I really don't know. I know I don't read them, and I went to law school and did real well. And I'm just hoping I don't get screwed, because I'm hoping there's some, you know, I'm hoping there's some legislature who's going to do something to make sure, and companies who are going to operate in, you know, in good faith. Do we know what percentage of people? Anybody done a study on it?
Co-chairs, Representative Smith, I'm not familiar with any study that's been done along those lines. It would be interesting. And to be honest, when I see an online contract, I assume that they're checking to see if I read it or not, so I read it. but no studies.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up. Yeah, I found it too, and I found it pretty fast. It's the only thing I know that's in here, because I didn't see anything else. And it took me about a minute. And if I want to know every single clause in this thing, you know, it's a 20-minute read. And am I going to do that for, you know, my Xbox? I have a PlayStation is what I use. And, you know, probably not. So the question to me is, you know, less who's to blame or, you know, who's, and more who is the best, who is the best holder of the responsibility? Who's the best holder of the risk? And it seems, who's most likely to have a team of lawyers, right? Who's most likely to be able to do something that's either more clear or less clear? And I don't think so I can see, you know, well, why didn't you read the contract before if you wanted to pay the $7? But also, like, well, why don't we just make it more clear? That doesn't seem like that big a deal. Seems okay.
If I could respond back to that, co-chairs and Representative Smith, my major advisor on my doctorate was a Vanderbilt attorney, and I soon realized lawyers are probably the worst to read contracts. They often don't. But, you know, things that stand out, if you change the font, you change the the bold, make it bold type, and change the font size. Those are simple things, but they do catch the eye.
Yeah.
The other thing is, instead of burying it in the contract, you also have a disclaimer up there that says, unless you opt out, you will be automatically renewed, or to automatically renew, check this box. I deal with a number of companies on the Internet that are very reputable, but it's the ones that don't that, like Representative Conger pointed out, they can be very irritating and sometimes can be very costly for some people, because they just don't have that money the second time around.
Thank you, Representative Sheehan.
I just want to make a comment for the record. I think the reason that Match.com has a 20-page disclosure is because of legislation like this, not in spite of it. I think this is very clear. I think that there are... The FTC already has best practices that govern this sort of thing. I just don't see that it's useful, and the examples given all have the mechanisms in place that this legislation tries to accomplish. So I don't see why we're here talking about this.
Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What was the Senate vote on this? It's not a committee vote, but I didn't see what the full Senate vote was.
29-1
29-0 with one excused.
Oh, 29-0 with one excused. Sheehan wasn't there that day.
Unanimous vote, I believe. So, any other questions of this panel? I would like to move on. There's other folks signed up to testify. I want to make sure everybody gets a chance, and appreciate your testimony today. Thank you. Up next, Sean Miller. And I got a note, Mike Dewey had to leave. So, no, he won't be testifying or... Okay. Sean, introduce yourself for the record, please.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of Assurian, who as a company does electronic mobile device insurance as well as other products. There's a few products I want to specifically talk about today, and I'm here in support of the Dash A4 amendment, and I want to discuss what the intent of the A4 amendment is to you today. But the example of a product I want to talk about that is actually part of the bill is data backup products. So, for instance, your computers, your cell phones, where you may want to purchase a data backup product that actually, and some of you may refer to this as a cloud, where it actually automatically saves your data. People pay for this service to actually have their data secure if they lose their phone, their computer. So that specific product is covered under the bill. And most of the auto renewal statutes around the country exempt out 30-day month-to-month rolling contracts. And so I want to specifically talk about that in the Dash 4 amendment, because under the bill currently, automatic renewal is defined in Section 2 of the bill. But I want to refer to Section 3 of the bill, sub B, where it talks about an unlawful trade practice if a consumer doesn't receive affirmative consent to the agreement after the definitive term. And so for someone who actually does month-to-month rolling contracts, because the consumer, again, in this case, wants to protect their data and they just pay month-to-month, I can tell you that it is unreasonable for a company or to expect consumers to get every single month individual consent. If you can imagine, what's going to happen is the consumer is actually going to be harmed by that, because they're not going to get their consent in, they're going to lose the product that they wanted because it's not going to be renewed, they're going to break their phone, lose their computer, and they're not going to have their data. And again, that's something that they signed up as a contract through a definitive term, and it just extends month to month. So I want to talk about the folks who testified in opposition to the Dash 4 saying that it guts the bill. If you look at the Dash 4 on line 6 of the bill, it specifically talks about the definitive term, but it allows the consumer to cancel. and then it talks about cancellation within 30 days or 1 month. And so again, a lot of the examples I heard may be annual subscriptions, annual service agreements. It's the same public policy that we're talking about with all the exemptions. When you look at on page 3, when you look at the exemptions, when you're talking about direct TV payment, where you're just you want the service of your TV, you're paying month to month, you want the service of this particular agreement, again, that's month to month, but you always have the ability to cancel within that month. And so it's a little different, and I did this bill was up on the last day for work session and the first public hearing on the last day in the Senate. I did approach Senator Bonamici about the amendment, wanting to clarify what automatic renewal was. There wasn't time on the Senate side, so I wanted to let the committee know that I have given the amendment to Senator Bonamici in hopes to clarify what an automatic renewal is not. And again, it's that 30-day rolling where you have the ability to cancel. So with that, Mr. Co-Chairs, that's what the Dash 4 tries to clarify. I think it still brings the original intent of the bill on some of these issues where you may, again, some of the examples I heard were, for instance, a foreclosure in a alarm company contract where there was a foreclosed property and the person couldn't get out of paying for their alarm system because of an automatic renewal in that contract. This, obviously, the Dash 4, if the bill is trying to protect those instances, the Dash 4 obviously only deals with 30 days with the ability for the consumer to cancel. So with that, Mr. Co-Chairs, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Sam Conger.
Well, Sean, the Senate vote was unanimous, so I'm not sure that I should be asking any questions. But
that's an excellent point.
Probably just wrap this up.
All right.
So I have to ask you, though, I'm looking, I think, at the Senate engrossed version of the bill, Section 3B, and it appears to me, the way I read it, it says it's unlawful to do any of the following: charge the consumer's credit or debit card or payment account with a third party for an automatic renewal or continuous service without first obtaining the consumer's affirmative consent to the agreement containing the automatic renewal offer terms or continuous service offer terms. I just want to make sure I understood your testimony. I read that to mean initially the consumer would have to, let's say, check a box or something if it was online or in a written contract, check a box that says, you know, I want to automatically renew. Mm-hmm. Is that not the way you're interpreting that?
It is. Mr. Co-Chair, as Representative Conger, it is in the definite term of a contract. You may sign up for this for, let's say, you know, 8 months or a year or 2 years. But again, it's month to month. And at the end of that term, it'll just continue as an automatic renewal. If you look down on page 1, line 20, it refers to continuous service. And that definition means plan or arrangement in which a paid subscription or purchasing agreement continues until the consumer cancels. It's this, just the way this is constructed, my client believes it doesn't allow for a 30-day, you know, any kind of product where it rolls, where the consumer is going to continue to pay monthly, and yet... it still would allow, or the way they read the bill, an unlawful trade if they don't continually get consent every 30 days, even though they're paying for it through it. And in this case, my client's through a third party, because normally it's on, let's say, your cell phone bill or another bill. It's a separate line item that you're paying for that data backup service. And so without canceling, Bill, the amendment allows you to cancel, but I think you would still have to somehow get consent to the consumer
every time,
and that's impractical. And I think you're going to see consumers harmed by that.
Other questions? Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Miller, you, in your testimony, you said that other states take care of this. Do our neighbors to the north and the south, and how do they address this the same way of your
amendment? Mr. Co-Chairs, I'm happy to look into specifically Washington, California, but my client, who does work in all 50 states, explicitly said most states do, and it could be all, I'll find that out, but most states explicitly deal with the 30-day, you know, the month-to-month rolling, where the individual has the ability to cancel. And specifically, the language I drew is from Indiana, in what in their legislation is what they had sent me. But again, I'm happy to look at what Washington, California. I can't say off the top of my head.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up,
Mr. Miller. Some of the exceptions we talk about are because the FCC has policy on this. Does FCC does not have policy that would affect your client?
No. And Mr. Co-Chair's Representative Wisnant, no. There is exemptions, for instance, under the actual cell phone insurance or mobile device insurance, the bill that this committee did pass, that would bring that under the insurance code, would specifically deal, you know, if passed in the Senate, which is scheduled next week, would deal with specifically, so, you know, that insurance product, because insurance products under DCBS are exempt, but it doesn't deal with those other products like the, you know, the data cloud, and there's others. But I do point out, a lot of states do it differently. I do know in California, they exempted specifically the alarm security companies, because they do a lot of those month-to-month. So a lot of states have picked different industries to target, to exempt, versus the way I'm trying to do it here, which, again, is dealing with the 30-day ability to cancel.
Thank you.
Thank you, and I just will maybe, I don't know if it's really a question or not, but on your Dash 4 amendments, it does refer to not a 30-day term, but a definite term. That would cause me a little bit of concern at this point if your goal is to impact 30-day terms. The bill appears to affect any definite term, whether it be annual or 10-year term or 2-day term. I'm not exactly sure. So I do have a little bit of an issue with that. And yeah, I'll have to look at this some more. I'm not sure that your issue is already covered in the bill. But I appreciate it. I'll have to have another discussion with you maybe after this hearing's over. We're not going to move this bill today. So with that, I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Cook.
Up next, I have Keith Dubanovich.
Good morning, Chair Holy, Chair Wisnant. My name is Keith Dubanovich. I'm Chief of Staff and Special Counsel in the Oregon Department of Justice. What I'll do is answer some of the questions that you already have asked and then kind of summarize what I think this bill does. First, this bill came out of a series of work sessions that began in 2009. And in great measure, it is based on California law, if not almost exactly California law. We're not exactly breaking new law here. Second, the exemptions that are in this bill came about because there was concern by a number of heavily regulated industries that they were already being required to do certain kind of disclosures. And so, not speaking on behalf of the sponsor, but that's my recollection that there was an exemption for those industries that are already heavily regulated. Representative Smith asked about, do consumers actually read things? And frankly, it's been our experience that in all honesty, they may read some parts of a consumer contract, but the reality is that most consumers, and including me, recognize that these contracts are take it or leave it. I don't have a choice. So whether I read the whole thing or not, if I want to purchase the good or service, I have to sign the contract. And so one of the things that we've found, which is true in housing contracts and any other consumer-type contracts, is that the significance of the typeface, the boldness of it, the color of it, those are the kind of things that are, frankly, most likely to be read by the consumer. If it's hidden in really small font, whether it's on a website or in a three-page contract, the consumer, frankly, isn't likely to read it. So one of the things that this bill does is says if you're going to have an automatic renewal provision, it's got to be clear and conspicuous. And that's the kind of language that is likely to be seen by the consumer, which is why this bill is, frankly, an advantage and a benefit to Oregon consumers. The Department of Justice has gotten a large number of complaints about automatic renewal provisions. As indicated in my testimony, written testimony on the bottom of the page, we've received 76 complaints in a little over the past year. And those are about industries that are not, that are subject to this bill, meaning that they don't relate to complaints involving industries that are exempt. And that's a fairly large number of complaints. And I know one, I think it was Representative Conger questioned, well, what good would we be doing by this? If we're able to educate 30 consumers to avoid contracts that are automatic renewing because they now understand that their credit card is going to be billed $30 a month for the next 12 months, then frankly, we've really helped a lot of Oregon consumers and reduced the workload on the Oregon Department of Justice. So in my view, that would be a substantial benefit to the state of Oregon. And while $7 in 1 month may not be a lot of money, the reality is that for a consumer that has that $7 charge for the next 12 months, it starts to become a fairly substantial amount of money. And for some companies, and I'm not going to say Microsoft is in this area, but there are some companies who their sole marketing and business model is to make it very difficult for the consumer to cancel. Because at some point, the consumer stops using the good or service, but it's stuck on their credit card. And so for $7 for the rest of the period of time, that's a tremendous profit margin for the company because they're not providing any good or service, but the consumer is stuck having to pay $7 a month. And so this bill basically tries to do three things. One, it tries to educate Oregon consumers. And that is one of the big things that we focus on in our consumer protection program, is trying to educate Oregon consumers. The smarter our consumers are, the less likely they are to enter into a transaction that they will dislike later on. Second, we believe that consumers should affirmatively consent to an automatic renewal provision. And the biggest problem we have are the annual contracts. The month-to-month contracts, frankly, as were described earlier, they're not a big problem because, frankly, at that point, the consumer can cancel in a relatively short period of time. Where we've had problems are people that sign up thinking, geez, I really like this service, and they get it for a month, and, you know, they really don't like it at the end of the month, but they're stuck with it for the next 11 months. That's the really big problem that we've had over and over and over again. And so by allowing the consumer to know that when they sign up for a good or service that they're going to be stuck paying for a whole year and requiring that language to be right in front of them when they click on purchase, we think that would be tremendously beneficial to the Oregon consumer. And if they're given a right to cancel, and we think they should be before a contract is renewed, they need to be provided the ability to cancel. And let me give you one example. We got a complaint from a lady who signed up. She was in Springfield, and she signed up for Mega Flex Pass. She thought, geez, you know, I see a lot of movies, sounded pretty good. She signed up, and when she got to the point where she didn't like the good or service anymore, she wanted to cancel. She said she spent over a half an hour searching on the website for some method of cancellation. There was nothing on the website that allowed her to cancel. So then she started doing more and more research online, trying to find a way to cancel. And she went back to her bills, and the bills didn't show Megaflex Pass. They showed a different company, Get My Bill. And so she spent a lot of time searching, and she started finding literally thousands of complaints about this company. And so after about 4 months of research, she finally gave up, contacted our office, and what usually happens is we take the consumer complaint, send it to the business, and most businesses, they simply don't want to fight with a Department of Justice, and they went ahead and canceled this lady's contract, but only after she had paid for 4 months of a service that she didn't want and didn't like. And so part of the difficulty that we've seen over and over again is consumers not having the information in front of them when they sign up for something that they're stuck with for the next year. So I'm happy to answer any of your questions about this bill. I have briefly looked at the A4 proposed amendment. As Representative Holvey indicated, it seems to apply to more than just 30-day term contracts. If the amendment was revised to say that if you're on a month-by-month contract, you don't have to require a consumer consent to continue that on a month-by-month basis, that sounds reasonable. But this seems to allow any kind of definite term contract to be renewed so long as you give the consumer some 30-day out after the contract is renewed, and that would include annual contracts. So, committee, happy to answer your questions.
Questions, Representative Sheehan.
So affirmative consent and clear and conspicuous language appear to be the main part of this. From what I'm reading, the FTC already demands that. Why is this law necessary if the FTC is already governing this on a national basis?
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnant, Co-Chair Sheehan. It's my understanding that the FTC regulates some industries, but not all industries, and doesn't get into the detail that this bill gets into, which is why California and a number of other states have recognized the void and have stepped in to provide additional regulation.
Follow up. And of the 76 that have come into your office complaining, just a rough estimate, how many of those did you find that were legitimately would not have fallen into this bill? Because I've got to assume a good chunk of these were people that just didn't read a contract that would have actually conformed to this bill were it law.
Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnant, Co-Vice Chair Sheehan, good question. I think the largest number are in the internet provider, internet retailer industry, not written offers and not television offers, although we do get a sizable number of complaints about television offers where somebody's up watching late night TV and calls for the special widget that they're going to get. I don't know the actual breakdown because we don't initially make a judgment on whether or not the advertisement is valid or not. Our initial attempt is to simply get the business to resolve the complaint with the consumer. And if they do, we don't spend any more time on it. It's only when we get repeat offenders, the same business that gets a number of complaints, that we then spend a little bit more time focusing on it, because at that point we recognize it's not an isolated event. And so of those 76, I'm going to guess about less than half of them are of the same company being a repeat offender. So it would be in those circumstances that I would believe that there's probably something problematic in their advertising or web space.
Thank you. Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Dubanovich, and your staff for helping our constituents when we have these these issues. Do you track the complainants by age and annual income?
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnant, we do not track age or income at all. I can generalize, but that's the best that I can do.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 487. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 491. Jan, could you give us a description of 491?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 491 modifies the requirements for notice of foreclosure and termination of tenancy for residential dwelling in foreclosures. There's no revenue impact. There's no fiscal impact. There are no amendments printed before you. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, the amendments came in late. We have, you have before you the dash A4 amendment and the dash A5 amendment.
Okay, can we have up Mrs. Hebb, Mr. Van Landingham. Paul, you want to come on up? Let's get the whole thing. Mr. Cosgrove. Good morning. Thank you for coming. Please give us your name and your concise testimony.
Thank you, Chair Wisnett, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today in support of Senate Bill 491 with both the dash, the A4 and the A5 amendments. I have submitted a section-by-section analysis of the bill, which should be in your bill files. I was emailed yesterday. The Law Center is, as you know, committed to achieving access to justice for low-income communities. Our clients struggle often to maintain access to safe and affordable housing. The foreclosure crisis has had a great impact on our clients, and particularly, and interestingly for me as I began to learn more about this issue, on tenants, people who are renting their homes from landlords who may be losing those homes due to a foreclosure. And we've seen an increasing impact on tenants because of the foreclosure crisis across Oregon. Even if tenants were paying their rent on time, if the landlord was not making the mortgage payment and the home went into foreclosure, what we saw was that tenants were losing their right to that housing. Where tenants are low income, that puts people at a special risk of homelessness, and that's been a great concern to us. The impact of this crisis has also been important to us from the perspective of the surrounding communities. You may know, it takes a long time, once a foreclosure sale is finished, for that home to move on in future sales. Often those homes sit vacant, and that's a negative impact on communities. We would far prefer and think it's fair and appropriate to have paying tenants in those homes if they were legitimate tenants in the first place, and that's good both for those families as well as for the communities because of the stability. So our concern comes from both of those perspectives. Prior to 2009, there were no rights for tenants. Even if they were legitimate paying tenants, they had no rights after a foreclosure sale, and that was a problem nationally. This legislature, with a bipartisan supportive vote in 2009, passed some initial protections. We worked on those. The Law Center and Lane County Legal Aid and Advocacy worked with members of the United Financial Lobby last session in 2009 to come up with a bill that did two basic things, and one was it provided tenants with notice that a foreclosure sale was going on and might affect their rights to their homes. It also provided them with some basic protections. Prior to eviction, you legislated last session that they would get either 30 days notice before they could be evicted after the foreclosure sale, or if they were long-term tenants in a fixed-term lease, they would get 60 days notice prior to an eviction sale, or after an eviction sale. And that was important basic protection. Soon after Oregon passed its law, the federal government passed another law that provided greater notice for tenants prior to eviction. The federal law provided 90 days notice after a foreclosure sale, or if the tenant was in a fixed-term, long-term lease, they were entitled to stay for the length of the fixed term. So in the past years, what we've noticed is that there's this inconsistency between the state and the federal law has caused some confusion, and there are also some remaining issues that we thought we needed to address. We reached out to work with members of the financial lobby and met with them first over the summer, met several times to discuss language. So this bill does not reflect everything that we would have wished initially, but it does reflect agreements that we came to with all of the interested parties. The bill comes to you from the Senate with a unanimous vote out of committee and off the floor. There are a couple of amendments pending, and I will direct you to my summary. I can just go briefly through the issues that the bill provides and describe the amendments, and then I'll be happy to answer any questions. So the first substantive provision of the bill is that it incorporates the new greater federal notices protection for tenants prior to eviction into Oregon state law. Of course, the federal law currently trumps state law, and so that's not an effective change to what rights tenants have, but it does resolve some confusion and inconsistency in the forms that are currently being used. We incorporate the 90-day notice prior to eviction and the protection for the fixed-term lease in Oregon statutes for the amount of time that those laws, those protections exist under the federal law. The federal law sunsets in 2014. So those additional protections for tenants would also, under our bill, would also sunset in 2014, coming back to Oregon's current protection of 30 days or 60 days prior to eviction for tenants. The other, another inconsistency that's resolved in the bill is what the definition of a covered tenant is. Last session, we passed the bill that provides protection for good faith tenants. The federal law provides protection for bona fide tenants. There are similar concepts, but the definitions are slightly different. We resolve the inconsistency by adopting the federal definition of bona fide tenant. That provision covers tenants protection for tenants if they are in a legitimate rental agreement that has been the result of an arm's length transaction and has the payment of fair market value rent, and there's a provision that says that it can't be an agreement between the tenant and the homeowner, the mortgagor, or a family member. So those are protections that are put into place to make sure that they're legitimate rental agreements. Another inconsistency that is resolved in the bill is that the current state law requires tenants, before they are entitled to any protection, to submit proof to the trustee within a certain time frame prior to the foreclosure sale. This was tripping tenants up. They got confused that foreclosure sale dates, as you all know, I'm sure, frequently get moved around. Often the tenants don't get information about when those dates get moved to, so that was confusing for tenants. It's also a requirement that's not allowed under the federal law, and so we resolve that consistency by removing that provision. We do, however, provide that if there is a notice provided to tenants, a 90-day notice to tenants on the assumption that the tenant does not have a fixed-term lease, if the tenant, if the notice provides information about where the tenant can send information to show otherwise, if the tenant does not do that within a certain time frame, they would not be entitled to protections of prevailing parties under the Landlord-Tenant Act. Talked a lot about enforcement and remedies for tenants if the provisions of these protections were violated. Our hope was to provide greater enforcement than the bill does, but we did negotiate some practical protections that we think will be useful. We remain concerned about this issue, and so we'll continue to watch it. Right now, I think the bill provides some good practical protections by amending the forms that are used in eviction proceedings and also requiring that the purchaser must attach the notice of eviction prior to starting the court process. I'll briefly speed through the rest of the provisions. An additional new provision that this bill provides is a notice to the tenant after the sale has taken place of the change in ownership. Last session, we all thought about how do we make sure that tenants know this might be going on. We forgot to think about how do we make sure the tenants know that it's finished. And so this bill will provide that tenants get notice when the foreclosure sale has taken place and they have information about who the new owner is and where they can contact that person. We also provided a few, I'll summarize them as saying they're sort of technical amendments related to how the FED, which is the expedited process that landlords can use to evict tenants, that process in court is the process that we provide should be used when a purchaser wants to evict a tenant, and that contains protections for both sides procedurally. And we also put into place a few other provisions of the Landlord-Tenant Act to clarify what the rights and responsibilities are of purchasers vis-a-vis tenants living in these homes. I want to take one step back quickly and just specify that last session we made it clear that a purchaser does not have to become a landlord. Many purchasers don't want to become a landlord. There are specific provisions in the statute that allow them to avoid that responsibility unless they sign a rental agreement or accept rent or fail to provide an eviction notice. And so we did, though, think that it made sense that there be some provisions of the Landlord-Tenant Act that should apply to guide these rights and responsibilities, even if the purchaser chose not to become a landlord. For example, if a purchaser wanted to get rid of a tenant who had behaved outrageously, there are provisions in the Landlord-Tenant Act that allow for a 24-hour notice prior to an eviction, and we thought they ought to be entitled to that protection by the same, or sort of on the flip side, we thought tenants should be entitled to protection from, for example, abusive access. The Landlord-Tenant Act provides that landlords can't just walk into the home. They need to give advance notice before they do that, and this bill would bring that provision in as well. So I am talking too much. Just briefly, the amendments are technical. They're not substantive. The A4s are from us, and they remove a superfluous provision of one of the service requirements that is just repetitive. And they also correct two cross-references. I'll let Mr. Cosgrove explain the A5s. They're also technical, and we have no concern with them and are supportive. So with that, I'll just pass it on and offer to answer any questions when you're ready.
Thank you. Whoever would like to testify next.
Thank you, Co-Chair Holby, members of the committee. My name is John Van Lanningham. I work as a lawyer at Lane County Legal Aid. I support 491. I've worked with Ms. Hebb for the past 3 years to address this issue in three sessions, 09, 10, and now this one. What we on our side, the tenant side, call the innocent tenant problem, in the sense that the tenant's done nothing wrong, performed under the rental agreement. It's the landlord who's defaulted on their obligation to a lender, been foreclosed upon, and the tenant's going to be the one who's going to pay the price by getting evicted and losing possession. I'm here as Ms. Hebb's assistant to answer questions because I have spent 30 years doing residential landlord-tenant law. So that's all I will say.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing the Oregon Financial Services Association and the other members of the United Financial Lobby. We are in support of the 491A bill. I'd like to just briefly say what the Dash 5 amendments do. They're 11 pages long, but literally all they do is eliminate two words. And they're two words that have nothing to do with the subject matter of the bill. As you know, when statutes are amended, legislative council does some grammatical cleanups. And if you'll turn to the bill on page 8, line 3, one of the grammatical cleanups that legislative council proposed when it did the A engrossed bill, and we caught it on the day, which was the last day the bill could move on the Senate, and we decided we'd clarify it here, is they add the word created prior to the trust deed. And this talks about the priority of interests in real property. That change is problematic from real property law. It has nothing to do with landlord-tenant law. It has nothing to do with foreclosure. So the dash A5s delete that word. And they delete it in the first line of the dash A5s, where it says on page 8 of the printed A and gross bill, line 3, delete created. The rest of the A5 amendment is necessary as a drafting matter. I'm not sure I understand exactly why Legislative Council did it this way, but if you look on page 22 of the bill, line 20, there is another word created at the end of that line, and in order to delete that one word, it took 10 pages of amendment by restating the whole section 7. I just want to assure you that all we're doing is deleting two words by an 11-page amendment, and they have nothing to do with the base bill, but they would change real property priority law if not clarified. So that's what the A5s are. We are still looking at the A4s, and I, since Ms. Hovey, Ms. Hebb.
Really?
It's Chair Harvey.
That happened.
Tell us something, or have I revealed the secret? I apologize, Mr. Chair.
There may be some exception to that comment.
Ms. Hebb gave us the ideas a couple of days ago, gave us the amendment yesterday. I think, frankly, there may be some concerns about the A4. I understand what the intent of it is, but I'm not sure we're quite there on the A4. So we can't support the A4 at the moment. We can support the base bill and the A5, and we'll continue discussions about the A4 to make sure that there aren't any substantive changes that we consider problematic. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Just one question. When do you think you would have time to get back to us on the A4?
Well, the A4 has been, Mr. Chair, the A4 has been sent out to the various associations, and it's being reviewed by their legislative committees and their attorneys. I would think within the next couple of days. So if you want to carry this to your next meeting, that would be fine, or early next week, whatever your pleasure is. It won't be terribly long. I just point out the reason we're so sensitive about reviewing this carefully is we've created a very complex system here, and we want to make sure we've been at it now for three sessions and had three sets of amendments of this system. We'd like this to maybe be the last time we have to amend these sections of law about the subject matter, and to subject you to all of this discussion.
Okay. Any other questions for this panel? So if in fact the A4s and the A5s were adopted, or, you know, I would also want some thoughts on whether they're compatible and could both be adopted, or do we need a whole new amendment if in fact we decide we like both of them?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, and Co-Chair Wisman, my understanding is that they're not inconsistent, so my understanding is that LC could put them both into the bill, and that the BN Grossed could move forward. And I should say, the A4s, and I understand Mr. Cosgrove will get back to us, but just for purposes of explaining to the committee, the first page of the A4s, they're similar to the A5s in that there are three lines that do three little things, and then it takes 7 pages to do the rest of it, and 10 pages to do the rest of it. And the reason that is that both of the changes, Mr. Cosgrove's change and our changes, are both amending a section of the bill that is sunsetted in 2014, and so the rest of the pages have to do with amending the provisions of the statute that will spring back into being after 2014. And so the only substantive pieces of the amendments are those first couple of lines. And as I said, the A4s merely delete a superfluous provision that's just redundant in the service requirements, and then there's a cross-reference in the service requirements talking about how notices are served. Right now the cross-reference is to the entire section that deals with all parties after foreclosure. It ought to be just to the section that deals with tenants after foreclosure, because the service provisions are only related to evictions of tenants. And so the only changes that we're making are, instead of having it be a cross-reference to Section C, we're saying it should be a cross-reference to Section C. Instead of having it be a cross-reference to Section 6, it's now, under the amendment, a cross-reference to Section 6C. So those are the changes.
I'm sure we all followed that.
Sorry.
So I appreciate your testimony. I'll look forward to the
conversation about the amendments. Appreciate your 3 years of work on this. I seem to have been involved in this for 3 years, too, it seems like. So with that, appreciate your testimony.
I appreciate your help. Thank you.
No one else has signed up on Senate Bill 491. I'm going to... Do we have written testimonies to put on the record? Just note for the record, we have written testimony and support submitted by Kenny LaPointe of Housing Works, Central Oregon Regional Housing Authority, and Janet Bird of the Housing Alliance. And so with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 491 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 294. As we, Jan, could you give us a description of 294? And Mr. Van Landingham appears to be signed up.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 294 changes the methods by which landlords may bill tenants for utilities or services, declares an emergency effective on passage.
If I might bring with me Chuck Carpenter from Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon and Pat Schwack, who is a longtime advocate for park residents.
Thank you. And if you'd reintroduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. John Van Landingham, Lane County Legal Aid and Advocacy Center in Eugene. I have given you an 11-page description of this coalition-produced bill. We do not have the amendments. I edited a draft on Friday morning. I edited another draft Sunday afternoon. And I hoped to get a last draft last night. I didn't. So I'm hoping to get that in time and have been negotiating with Legislative Council to get it right for him and for us. So this bill amends Manufactured Housing Park landlord-tenant law. And that's a specific kind of tenancy in which the tenant owns the manufactured home, lives in the manufactured home, and rents a space in a park. Parks defined as four or more spaces. So, more commonly known as a mobile home park, or we're trying to learn to call it manufactured dwelling parks. Because manufactured dwellings now are very nice and can cost six figures. So, this coalition was formed in 1997, consists of park residents, park landlords, manufacturers. Don Miner is in the audience somewhere. He's a member of the coalition. Sybil Hebb is also a member of the coalition. We have 25 active members, and we have negotiated a compromise bill amending manufactured home park landlord-tenant law in every session since 1997. Worked by consensus, and this is that bill for this session. We met 19 times between the 2009 session and this session, starting in October of 2009, and each meeting is typically at least 3 hours at Don Miner's office. We also had significant participation this last time from Senator Bonamici, because one of the two main issues we worked on, sub-metering of water, is something she's especially interested in due to manufactured home parks in her district. And so she met with us. The bill really amends two sets of existing laws, and I'm not going to go through the detail of it unless you want me to, and I'll bet you don't. those two issues are, again, existing statutes which already encourage park landlords to switch from in-the-rent billing of water or what a master meter that's pro rata, in which typically residents pay a per-space proportion of the bill. So you have one master meter. It measures all the water consumed in the park. If there are 100 spaces, each tenant pays one-hundredth. So if you are a single person living alone using water, you pay the same amount as a family with three teenagers taking two showers a day. Doesn't matter. You're in a pro rata apportionment of the bill, you're going to pay the same. Landlords, when most of these parks were built in the 70s and 80s, water was cheap. And landlords were covered for the cost of water in the rent. It's no longer cheap. It's not ever going to be cheap. It's going to get more expensive. It includes sewer and wastewater and stormwater. Landlords want to get out from under that cost. Tenants want to be able to control that cost. We all want to encourage conservation of water. So the coalition has, in a number of bills, tried to encourage submetering of water. A 2009 bill requires larger parks that recover for water with this master meter pro rata method, not if they include recovering the rent, not if they use only well water, but these larger parks are required to submeter, to switch to submeters by the end of 2012 as part of a 2009 bill. There are problems with that. For some parks, it's not practical. There are also cost implications. So what the bill does is try to help make that occur. One, by providing an exception from the mandatory submetering requirement if a park takes what we're calling super conservation pro rata steps, bills more based on the number of occupants in the unit as compared to all the occupants in the park, and also based on the size of the space. So we're trying to find things that reflect consumption but can still be done without an actual submeter on the space. And also require the landlord to test for water leaks in the common areas. A lot of tenants have concerns about older parks having leaking pipes in the common areas. Those are the landlord's responsibility, so the bill will require an annual test by the landlord for leaks in the common areas and fixing significant leaks. The bill would also require the landlord to test for free the residence unit. Right. Typically, that's the resident's responsibility. But this will require the landlord to test for leaks in the resident's manufactured home and make the landlord responsible for leaks in the connection between the edge of the space and the actual home to repair there as well. And the landlord can, this may be harsh, but can require the tenant to repair that leak. And if the tenant doesn't, we'll evict the tenant who doesn't do that. We'll try to build in some protections there. The second main thing done with regard to submetering of water, it has to do with how a landlord pays for the installation of the submeters. When we first encouraged submeters in 2005, we thought they would be cheap, $50. We've learned either we were wrong or the cost has gone up. It's now somewhere between $300 and $800 per submeter, depending on how fancy you get. But at an average cost of $500 a submeter for a 200-space park, you're talking about $100,000. That's a difficult amount to borrow in these times, and we were unable, despite a lot of work, especially by Senator Bonamici, to find any public financing for this switch. So what we've done here is to allow the landlord to adopt a special assessment, which would bill the tenant as part of the monthly utility charge for the actual only, the actual cost to install the submeters, but spread over 60 months, so that the actual cost to the tenant should be bearable. We've done a number of other things which we think will hopefully reduce the cost of doing this. One of those has to do with a BCD program called the Minor Plumbing Label Permit Program to reduce permit costs. BCD representatives are in the back of the room in case you want to know more about it than that, because I don't. But they helped us draft the language to make that work. The second major issue that we worked on in the bill has to do with converting parks to subdivisions. I'm not going to say much more than that. If Representative Clem were here, I would, because in 2009, he submitted three bills to try to address a problem in a park that converted to a subdivision in his district. Those bills had problems. I made a commitment to him in 2009. There wasn't time to fix them. I made a commitment to him that the coalition would work that issue and bring it back. It's here. And I think we've addressed the issues. It's not going to be perfect. It's not a perfect transaction switching from a park to a subdivision where tenants buy their lots or somebody buys their lot. But we think we've improved it. I'll stop there.
Thank you. If you'd like to give your testimony in a short fashion, I would appreciate it.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Pat Schwach, and I represent residents and half or some, however long the coalition's existed. I'm here to testify on this bill, and as John said, we've worked very hard on it. It's been a long, long grind. And it addresses a number of issues that all residents face. That's about all I have to say on this bill. I'd like you to take a look at the piece of paper that accompanies this, and it addresses Kitzhaber's concerns, and that's when he was Speaker of the House, of the Senate, my friend, the President of the Senate. And it goes back to May of 1989. Also in this, I talk about the fact that the reason we've come to this place is that then-Senator Kenemer insisted that the landlord stop abusing us, because Frank Burleson and I had gone and cried long and loud about how terrible we were treated. He insisted that there become a coalition, that the landlords and the residents work together, and what we have now is an absurdist. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, co-chairs, committee. My name is Chuck Carpenter, executive director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. We represent about 500 manufactured home communities in Oregon. I'll be very brief here. I'd like to thank John for his hard work on this bill. He's done a marvelous job with the coalition over the years. I've been on the coalition since 1999. It provides us with an excellent venue to resolve a lot of the issues that we face. The decisions we've made in the coalition have not always been easy. and not always been pleasant experiences. We've dealt with some really tough issues over the past number of years, but I think it's to the benefit of this institution that we were able to resolve these issues and bring them to you rather than having these constant fights that we are prone to. And I also like to thank Pat for her work. And overall, I think we're very pleased with the product we have this year. There's the two issues, conversions and submetering. I'd like to thank Senator Bonamici for her work on the submetering issue, because we dealt with water submetering back in 2003, and because of some national issues, could not get the issue resolved to what landlords wanted. And I think a lot because of her hard work on Senate Bill 929, although we opposed for other reasons, clarified that finally that a manufactured home community in the state of Oregon can submeter water, and that is it's a very big positive win for those people who own manufactured home communities in Oregon. It's a win for the environment, and I think it's a win for the residents as well. So we're waiting to see the amendments, and if they do what we've all agreed that they're supposed to do, we certainly have no problem with the bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Kutcher, could I add one thing? I know you're not tight. I want to mention something for the record, because some of you may have heard concerns raised by some other players in this area, including coalition members. The bill does not include anything. The amendments will not include anything having to do with an issue that we call opportunity to purchase. Some call right of first refusal. It has to do with whether the residents can organize and buy a park when a landlord is trying to sell it. It's an issue that we negotiated in the coalition. We ended up not reaching agreement on the coalition. We had some significant disagreement from some landlords, and some residents were concerned about losing the whole bill. So it is not going to be in the amendments. And those landlords who are watching carefully hopefully will see that when the amendments are printed.
Thank you. I appreciate that clarification. It was actually something that I had a question about. So any other quick questions from the committee on this bill?
No questions to comment.
Representative Clem.
I just want to thank him for working. This was a really disastrous situation. And in fact, it had submetering and unlawful submetering at the time in this issue out in my district. I have 17 parks in my district, and one of them was being converted into a subdivision, and as this indicates, that wasn't something that was worked out by this coalition. Somebody else came up with that statute and made it law, and this is the one experience I had with it, and it was disastrous. So I'm thankful to the coalition for reviewing it and trying to make some improvements.
Thank you for that comment, and Mr. Van Landingham acknowledged that piece while you were out of the room.
I heard him. I was listening.
And I appreciate you bringing that issue forward as well and working on it. Not seeing any, I really appreciate all the hard work again, Mr. Van Landingham and Chuck and Pat, for sticking together on these issues and trying to work them out. And also, for the record, we have committee members. We have a letter in support of 294 received from Jen Tonneson, owner of the Rocky Point Marina in Portland, Oregon. And not seeing any other discussion, I will close the public hearing as we await the amendment. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 294. And committee, we will carry over. Senate Bill 292. We're going to carry over
all of these bottom ones? Senate Bill 487, Senate Bill 491, and Senate Bill 294. And so we got bills off our plate.
Yep.
And with that, we will adjourn the House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection.
Good job.